Hello. First, I'd like to say I'm very happy to be here. Very grateful to the organizers for inviting me. I'm just not going to be able to get that up when I need it. I have not been a part of this community before, so it's been a real eye-opener to me to see how much all of you here have been working on my problem, and I didn't know it. My background is primarily as a modeler and numerical analyst, not an analyst and not somebody who's been looking at pattern formation for these sort of mean field equations. So it's been a very enriching experience for me to see how far the sort of harder theory has gone relative to, say, some other modeling problems. And many of you have done bioconvection. I've got a maybe different way of looking at it, so I hope, if nothing else, I can leave you with another problem, which for you is a gift, right? It's not a bad. And I have a little prologue here. And again, to let you know how much I've been enriched, I had never heard of the Ginzburg-Landau equation before I came here. So the things I'm going to show you, the problem I'm interested in is very rich. And I know that some of you have looked at it, and I think some of you would be interested in looking at it, because all the things that I've seen talked about over the past few days show up here. And now I just called them convection cells, for example. And obviously a room full of very smart people have been working for quite a long time on describing them with all sorts of other powerful tools. And so let's see if you can do it to this one also. So I'm going to be talking about bioconvection, so pattern formation and a suspension of swimming microorganisms. So microorganisms move around according to all sorts of very interesting rules. Chemotaxis over here is one of them. My pointer here is anybody else here red-green colorblind? No? Yeah, it's very bright is the point. So the red pointer that somebody just had seemed to be fine, but I have the worst problem seeing the pointers that most people use, so I went and got my own. And really what I should have done is given it to all the speakers, right, so that I could see what they're pointing at. But it seems too powerful, and I didn't want to accept the liability of blinding the audience. Anyways, all right, so over here we have E. coli, a microorganism. It's motile, it moves on its own, and these happen to be chemotactic, and they've moved through this fluid medium towards an enzyme, I think, coming out of this capillary tube. So they are obviously discrete organisms, and en masse they've locomoted here. In the middle is Chlamydomonas nivalis, and they're undergoing phototaxis. On the left is a micrograph of streaks of these. This is an algal cell with two flagella. And the difference between the left and the right picture is on the right picture, an illumination, a light source has been turned on the left or the right, and they've started moving towards it or away from it. So they're phototactic. And over here, Magnetosporillum magnetotaxitacidum is a magnetotactic microorganism. So it swims, but it has small bits of iron stuck inside of it, so it's actually influenced by magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field actually points into the Earth just slightly. So these guys living on the bottom of the seafloor, when you start mixing things up, they'll swim back down into the bottom through a purely sort of mechanical response. So microbiologists studying these microorganisms maybe aren't as interested in this one, although that seems really neat to me. I don't know how that would have evolved. But over here, there's some mechanism by which the cell detects the concentration of some chemical gradient, say a nutrient. So it's got some sort of sensors, detects that internally, and makes some sort of change in its motility behavior. And this is my considered a joke, how do taxis go around? We have taxi taxis. Yeah, it's not a very good joke. So I'm going to model for most of the rest of this Chlamydomonas nivalis, and it's a biflagellar algal cell, which has two flagella. There's one, there's another. And it swims through a kind of a breaststroke, so it sticks its flagella up and brings it back down, and John Kessler does this much better than I do, but I think he dances a little more. And it has what we call geotaxis or negative gravitaxis, and that's because it has this chloroplast that's behind the center of buoyancy, and it's heavier than the rest of the material in the cell, so it's actually a purely passive mechanism that'll make it swim up. So if it's in a gravitational field, it'll rotate the point up and swim to the surface, barring anything interesting going on. And over here is the actin that's active to drive these flagella. So there are people out there who are trying to determine what is the actual sort of biochemistry, microbiology mechanism to do that. And please stop me if you have any questions. Numerically, they have, sure. not real life experiments. I take that back. I don't know that. I haven't read anything about it. But ask that question again at the very end when I ask for applications, because I'm looking for some. Oh, I didn't set this up properly. Biologists are kind of strange people. When I go and steal stuff from the web all the time to get nice pictures, and they seem to be preoccupied with mating rituals of algae cells. So they have conjugation pairs, early mating pair, and this is a movie of a whole population of them conjugating. Yeah, and I'll skip the movie. I don't know what the laws are in Canada, so we'll just go on. So bioconvection, and I know many of you already know this, but if you don't know what bioconvection is, you start off with a small fluid height layer with a population of cells, say the geotactic algal cells, and they swim up, say through that purely passive mechanism that just orients them to point up, and they get to the top and start to collect there. The only problem is that these cells are slightly more dense than the fluid they're in. So now you have a density instability, and under many circumstances, it's unstable, much like the Rayleigh-Bernard convection, except it's the buoyancy is in it's opposite, right? The cells are heavier as opposed to the heated fluid being lighter. So you can think of this a little bit as maybe Rayleigh-Bernard convection, but your little packets of heat move around on their own. So you get this. Because of the density being too high and it's unstable, you get plumes starting to form. It's a feedback kind of instability. Once this downwelling region forms, it pulls in more cells above it, so it becomes even more unstable. The plume hits the bottom, or the plume breaks up, depending on how deep the chamber is, and they start to swim back to the surface. So some of the parameters you can change here to get different kinds of effects are change the height of the chamber. The deeper it is, the less stable configurations will be. Increase the number density of the cells. Change the world as in microgravity. There's other many parameters involved. Here's some pictures of bioconvection in a petri dish. So left to right is time, and the difference between the top row and the bottom row is the bottom one is about 6 times the number density. And these are steady state patterns, but of course things are still transient So you get spots. And here's a couple circles. And as the density goes up, you get maybe a more stable wavelength, but the pattern, of course, is still transient. And you get all sorts of different kinds of pictures. So that's a very good question. So the claim is the color you see here is correlated to the number density integrated in a vertical line. So the denser, the darker areas have higher cell population. And I brought a couple other pictures that I'll show very quickly. And I went and grabbed these a couple days ago. After I saw the kinds of pictures everyone else had, I felt left out that I didn't have stripes. So here's a... Is it stripes? Yeah. It's backwards, but that's okay. Here is a real picture of that process I just described from the side. So you have cells swimming to the surface. They collect, form plumes, the plumes come down, and under some circumstances, this might be very stable. Under other circumstances, it won't be. There are questions I'm interested in. I think the biologists are interested in them, such as for this kind of bioconvection, one of the secondary effects is that if there's a nutrient diffusing in from the surface, as these cells form, they entrain more nutrients. So if this population was just some sort of exponential decay, maybe the population wouldn't see as much nutrients as if you had bioconvection. So I haven't found anything more than that kind of supposition about it. And on the right is another sort of, it's approaching another phase where you have much like your transitions, you go from dots to maybe circles to stripes. In this case, the stripes would be curtains of infalling cells. Yeah, it's just probably 3 millimeters for the height, maybe more. The organisms are, so I think these are bacteria, and they're probably something like 5 microns in length and a micron wide, half a micron wide. Here's some stripes. That looks awfully familiar. Thinking. So what have other people done on this? Well, of course, they've looked at it analytically. I don't think I've seen anybody, up until a couple of years ago maybe, look at very complex behavior in these sort of mean field theories. So Levendow, and I know I've forgotten some people on this list, I just hope none of them are actually in the room. Levendowski, Childress, and Spiegel started by looking at, take an initial configuration, call it exponentially decay, and look at the linear stability of that initial overturning. So that's excellent for applications of linear stability analysis, but it really has nothing to do with the long-term transient dynamics of the system. Do you know when? So here's a problem I've come to recognize. I'm not part of this community, so it's entirely possible this has been done and I haven't looked for it properly. Well, good. You can tell me to look harder when I'm done. Pedley, Kessler, and Hill, same types of things, but more complicated taxis. So I'm talking here, they do geotaxis, maybe with a little gyrotaxis, but we'll get to some of the differences that you can't incorporate in a mean field theory, or if you could, things become so complex that you probably can't do much with it afterwards. And I'm sort of speaking a little out of my own place here, because I haven't actually done the kinds of mean field theories that you all have. So if I said something wrong, that's probably correct. I probably just said something wrong. So in modeling these, once you sort of give up trying to get the strong analytic results, the kinds of models you can come up with are much more complicated, and then you can do numerical simulations. Some people have looked at a numerical simulation where you have a background fluid and you represent your cell population as a scalar that's a number density. Childress and Perret did a precursor of what I'm going to talk about, which is you have a background fluid, which is a continuum and possibly a background chemical species, upon which you place a large population of discrete representatives that are the actual swimming cells. So I'm going to end up talking about individual cells, and once I bring it down to that level, I can put on very complicated responses. So this isn't going to be all that interesting to you, so I'll try to go through this a little fast. Here's a cell. I associate with it a swimming vector, which is equivalent to, of course, saying a swimming orientation angle in 2D. And the cell, its position evolves according to advection by the fluid and its swimming speed and its swimming direction. So what I'm going to do is come up with models, right? So this is a very simple framework. I'm going to come up with models for a swimming speed and a swimming direction. And I can incorporate all these different kinds of tactic responses. And here's the simplest geotactic one. So it swims at a constant mean speed determined by experiment, say, and it always swims up. So it turns out that's not very interesting, but that's a very simple model you could do. You can force the orientation angle to follow its own evolution. And then, of course, you can include cell-to-cell variability by including some stochastics. So this is really a Wiener process of some sort. So you evolve the cell's orientation angle, and there's some stochastic noise. Again, you can determine that through experiment, or try to. Historically, people looked at geotaxis and didn't look at gyrotaxis because it's easier. Of course, nothing undergoes pure geotaxis. They're all gyrotactic. And all gyrotaxis says is your cell is actually rotated according to the local vorticity of the fluid. So you can't actually get rid of that. It's always present. And here's an equilibrium angle. So what's happening there is the cell wants to swim on its own, and maybe it has this restoring torque due to the chloroplast, but the fluid it's in wants to rotate it. So those can balance at certain angles. There's an experiment John Kessler does where he takes a vertical tube of pond water and has circulation in it, and when you look at it, there's nothing there. Over time, perturbations form, and you get a downflow in the tube. Well, that tends to rotate cells towards the center, and if you wait a little longer, you start to see a green line into the center of this tube where all the cells have been gyrotactically forced. So that really isn't there. Yeah, no. That's right. And then, of course, you could do a temporal evolution of the angle. And it depends on what kind of scales you're interested in as to whether or not a temporal evolution makes sense. And then you can add stochastic processes. And for chemotaxis, we talk about a swimming speed and a swimming direction. This would be perfect chemotaxis. Somehow the cell detects the actual gradient. So probably that doesn't happen in many cases. And then you can get more enriched pieces in your model till you get to a point where you say there's a consumption function that maybe looks like a Heaviside function, or maybe it looks like an exponential increase until it saturates, beyond which an increase in nutrient doesn't make any difference to the cell because it can't do anything with it. Below some minimum nutrient level, maybe it's not motile anymore. So you have these uptake functions. So what's a run-and-tumble chemotaxis model? Well, if you take something that's just a couple microns long, it seems unreasonable to expect it to detect a spatial gradient. So here's a way to translate detection of a spatial gradient, throw that out, have a detection of a temporal gradient, and still be able to exhibit motion towards a nutrient source. So the idea here is the cell knows a short history of what it's seen in the nutrient. If that indicates everything's good, then it has a low probability of randomly reorienting. If that indicates things are going poorly for the cell, the probability of randomly reorienting goes up. So if you take some billions of cells operating under that, you get bulk motion. Yeah. That's right. So the
normal model for the brain works is it all takes place between the cells. That's what that one's off in chemistry. It's motor on forward or backward, stochastically depending on
what's there. Yeah. So I have Stokes equations really with a Boussinesq approximation. And within a numerical model, I still have this factor that says one of these notional cells represents some number of real cells. Although in each individual cell moves, each computational, cell moves as if it were a single cell. And if I'm doing chemotaxis, there's a chemical transport equation where the consumption function is tied to the cell's consumption rate. And oh, yeah. Transparencies. Do I have just a few minutes left? Is that right? Ah, good. So these are numerical models, numerical simulations done some years ago. And the difference between these three, so here, let me explain this, I guess. This is a two-dimensional domain, so like those pictures, you're looking at it from the side. There's a nutrient diffusing in from the surface, shown by the colors here. The simulation had many more of these discrete particles than shown. This is just a sampling of them. That should be enough. This white line represents a minimum nutrient threshold below which the cells are no longer motile. These convection rolls can clip them and pull them out of this section and re-entrain them in a in a region of the fluid where the nutrient is high enough that it revives. And all I vary between these three, and I probably should have started with the other picture, are those consumption functions and the swimming speed function. So heavy side are exponential, and you can't tell so much there. And the last ingredient is this is the run-and-tumble model. And over here, same type of variation, except you have these bugs over here actually have a gradient detecting mechanism. So that these are very, very smart. And these have a small history, time history that they go by. So you get very qualitatively different kinds of answers. So how do you derive a mean field theory kind of model that incorporates these two differences? Of course, it can be done. Once you go through these steps, do you end up with something that's so complicated that, it shows there's lots more work to do, right? And I left a really good picture in my office. But I do try to look at the kinds of things on the path towards what you all do. So this is talking about a series of geotactic calculations, so no more chemotaxis. They swim up with some noise, different heights of chambers. Over here is the number of plumes in a chamber. They all have the same width. Here is a wavelength. I can measure how steady those numbers are. So I'm trying to get at some idea as to how stable the configurations are. Right? And this is very naive to you all, but with nothing else to go on, this is the first cut. I can talk, so here's something that might be very interesting. in these convection rolls, what's the average cycle time for a cell? So that's more of a three-dimensional issue. And if you're talking about chemotaxis with these boundaries where things are no longer motile, you're getting to a much more three-dimensional issue. Depends on how much work you want to do, right? So one of the things I came here for that I'm very happy to see is I don't know what to measure. These are 2D. I'm doing 3D now. What in the world do I measure that makes sense to compare, to experiment, and to look for deeper features? So I can say that the wavelengths increase as the height increases, but if I look at cell length to width ratios, those actually are fairly constant. So these are features that I'd like to know what to do with. Are these the good features to look at, or are they sort of not important? Thank you. So, as I said, more recently I've been extending the same ideas, but to full 3D numerical models. And for those of you who are interested, it's coupled to a finite element method. Each of these cells is evolved according to its own ODE and its own time-stepping mechanism. The delta functions get spread out, and they're essentially using the basis functions for the velocity equation, the momentum equations. I think even experimentalists, don't know what cells really do when they start to hit boundaries. So when they get to the surface, they're not interacting as sort of free swimmers, right? But I don't think anyone has a really good idea of what happened, so I take the easiest way out, and I say, we'll just stop them once they get to half width from the top. And they're 3D transient, so they're big 3D calculations. The physical domains are 2.5 centimeter squares with a third of a centimeter in depth for a short one, and I do another one that's 4 times that height. So for 3D, I'm going to show the same kind of feature that I could show with the 2D models. Essentially, a lower height can give you stable patterns, and a deeper height, things get very complicated. And if you're interested in the rest, you can. Oh, I do want to point out a little dirty laundry here. If you take the factor I had to use to get the patterns, it's not right. So it's a factor of, say, 5 too large. So if I say I'm not going to make things clean enough to do rigorous analysis on it, I better buy something with that. And the thing I'd like to claim to buy is I'm closer to reality. But so I'm pointing out here that as of today, no, that's not really the case. There's still some unknowns involved here. Here's a typical mesh. So what we're looking at here is a simulation looking from perspective. So you're a little above the container. You can't see it so well here, but it's 2.5 centimeters. It doesn't help me to point my finger. 2.5 centimeters, 2.5 centimeters, 318 microns. And you'll see this feature where they swim to the surface and they seem to collect in the upper plane. A few more minutes? Okay. They seem to collect in the upper plane for some time before the patterns start to form. So this is a funny to me, consequence of when I uniformly distribute these particles in this domain, I do better than reality. So the instability onset is delayed, sort of artificially, compared to in a lab. Whoops. So those look stable, right? They're still bouncing up and down, and they're transient. They're starting to sort of eat each other up, and here's the same thing from the side. I sit here and look at these all day thinking I'm seeing very deep things. And you all tell me, yeah, I was. I just don't know what they are. Here's the same thing from the top. And those the experimentalists who took those earlier pictures mentioned rings, and I can come up with a couple reasons why you might have them. The infalling region moves away from a point into a circle, right? Or possibly when the plume hits the bottom, when it swims back up, it can have the shape of a ring, because experimentally you're just integrating the entire length, so you don't know. Yeah, so this is, I sort of think as the fluid flow is a tool, right? I'd like it to not be a big part of the problem, but it is. So it, that's right. So it's sort of a fat porous with a point, and then the point spreads out to a circle, and then it connects to other ones. And so here I'm doing the thing that's four times as deep, and the amount of data is massive. So here I had to clip out more planes. So it goes by very quickly, and the point of showing this is things are much more complex, and is there something regular in any way happening here? And you can color code things because you can, and I'll just keep that up for a little bit. So this is very fine structure, right? And so future work, there's, I mean, that's why I'm very happy to be here, specifically this kind of stuff. I don't know what to measure that's meaningful, and I don't want to waste very much time measuring things just because I can. And applications. So where I work, if they really want an application to be present. It's a couple stages away from sort of pure research, so I keep asking groups of people if they know if this is applicable to anything. And since I don't really have the time to do this work properly, I always ask if there are students or other people interested who I can push a lot of this work on to. That's it. Thank you.